Members, we're going to get started. We're not at quorum, but it's important for us to keep to move rather rapidly today. We've got several bills up, and we still have to finish yesterday's testimony. So with that, I'm going to ask Representative Cass to assume the gavel while we finish House File 1186. We have a couple of testifiers that have asked to testify. We weren't able to get them in yesterday. So under the principles of fairness and openness, we are we want to make sure that we hear that testimony. And then it would be my intention that we go ahead and proceed and move on this bill. So Representative Cash.
Okay.
I'm sorry. It's House File 501. I'm looking at the wrong notes. I'm trying to move too quickly here.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right, like Representative Mariani said, we're going to continue with public testimony on House File 501 as amended from yesterday. We're working off the DE2 amendment, so I hope that everybody has that. That was adopted in yesterday's committee. And I'd like to call down the following testifiers, Stacia Smith as well as Jim Bartholomew. Good morning. If you would just state your name, and you can begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And I want to thank the chair and the author and the committee for the opportunity to speak today. In short, we'd ask that you not pass House File 501. As you know, this bill eliminates the requirement that high school students be able to pass the reading and math grad to earn a diploma. Why shouldn't we simply repeal this requirement? In 1997, when the state first required all students to pass the basic skills test in reading, writing, and math, we created a common set of minimum academic expectations for all students. What happened when students and districts got those initial BST results and those results weren't as good as they expected them to be? Districts around the state re-examined their instructional practices and their curriculum to see what changes were needed. Students discovered that the state was serious about expectations and they improved their focus. In short, requiring students to pass the BSTs to earn a diploma created significant incentives for improvement. And the changes that were made are a positive reflection on our schools and our students. And if anybody ever wants, I've got a number of articles from the late 1990s, 2000, that summarizes a lot of the things that our schools and our students did in response to the BSTs. They did have an impact. Finally, after 10 years, in recognition of the rising global demands for student achievement, the state replaced the BSTs with the grads. Some people have suggested we should have stayed with the BSTs. But ask yourself, what's changed between the mid-1990s and now? How many of us have seen the Did You Know clip or Shift Happens? A little 8-minute thing on YouTube or elsewhere. It starts out with some pretty sobering statistics. For example, the number of 2006 college graduates in the United States, 1.3 million. In India, 3.1. In China, 3.3 million. In 10 years, the number one English-speaking country in the world will be China. And finally, a third comment in Did You Know? We are currently preparing students for jobs and technologies that don't yet exist. In order to solve problems, we don't even know our problems yet. Raising our expectations for high school graduates from the BSTs to the grad was an excellent decision. As was commented yesterday, somewhat disputedly, I guess, but It is important to remember that the grant is based on the reading and math standards that were implemented in 2004 when the class of 2010 was in the sixth grade. They were not based on the recently adopted 2008 math standards that require Algebra 2 in high school. At one of your earlier hearings about statewide testing, someone described the process for making change in our educational system as something akin to turning the Titanic. Things must change slowly. We agree. Change must be deliberate and done carefully. However, we also have to remember that about 55,000 students graduate from our public schools each year. And these students will enter a global economy that is increasingly competitive, knowledge-based, and will require more post-secondary education. Lowering our expectations for high school graduates, as House File 501 would do, does not help us close our achievement gap or improve student preparation for and completion of post-secondary education, as is reflected at the end of our letter. And again, you got a joint letter from us in the chamber yesterday. And on the back, there's some statistics about high school completion broken out by ethnic groups or racial groups, as well as post-secondary completion rates at both 4- and 2-year institutions. Instead, we suggest linking diplomas to achievement on statewide assessments leads to positive change. Raising expectations for what our students need to know is essential if they're going to succeed in our global economy. And creating exceptions to higher expectations, even on a short-term basis, will make future progress more difficult. This is a complex issue, and we look forward to continuing to work with you to find both a short-term and a long-term solution that best meets the needs of our students. Thank you.
All right, now we'll open up to questions. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't believe that just increasing the standard automatically will result in higher achievement unless you put the resources behind it to make that happen, which, as I know you follow education, so I know that you understand what the situation of our education system has been in Minnesota in the last few years as far as not really even keeping up with inflation. And so I get my question for you is, are you and your group willing to support a tax increase so that we can fund education properly so that we can get to the level that we need to be so we can pass these tests? 37 or 38%, whatever it is, passing this test is not certainly not where we want to be, and it'll take a significant amount of money, at least in my opinion, I think the opinion of an awful lot of people that know more about it than I do, in order to get 70 or 80% to pass this. And so my question is, are you and your group willing to support a tax increase to pay for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Faust, first of all, I think it depends on how you talk about increases in funding K-12. I know there's been a fair amount of discussion. If you look at increases in funding for K-12 from 1996, 2002, pick a number in a lot of cases. If you look at increases in funding in K-12 on a per student basis using the Consumer Price Index, we are exceeding the rate of inflation. If you're looking at it using the implicit price deflator, you get another number. So on a per student basis, funding in Minnesota over the years, and again, it all depends on which years you pick to compare and what inflation rates you use. I guess I'm not denying that there aren't, you know, money is an important factor, but I think you have to also look at how you construct your comparison of funding. I think more importantly for most school districts are their enrollment numbers over the years. Again, generally, on a statewide basis, funding from 1996 to 2009, at least off the top, compared to CPI on a per-student basis, is beat inflation by about 20%. Further, our look at how K-12 funding globally compares, based on some work done by McKinsey, The United States spends more than almost any country, certainly within the OECD. Just simply spending more is not going to be the answer. It's a critical component of the overall answer. But I think we argue it's a little bit more important to look at how you spend your money. It's not simply that the state needs to provide more money, but districts are looking at things like enrollment. I mean, there are a number of districts that have received substantial increases in funding, but they haven't been enough to offset their loss in student enrollment. So that's a quick response, I guess.
Representative Fouts, did you have a follow-up?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess we can agree or disagree whether schools are maintaining their funding levels or not, but if we're going to obtain, you know, increase the number of math teachers we've got, increase the number of math classes that we've got, because I looked at the test yesterday, and there are, I mean, like I said yesterday, there's trigonometry questions in there. I think there's one that's borderline calculus even. And so we're going to have to significantly increase the number of students in Algebra 2 and geometry and trigonometry and all those classes. We're going to not only just have to add more math teachers, we're going to have to extend the school day, which I don't think is a bad thing. But if we start doing that, we're going to have to add, whether you like it or not, we're going to have to add a lot more money to do that, or we're going to have to extend the school year. And I don't think that the teachers are just going to say, oh, that's a good idea, and do that. I think that, you know, they're going to say, yeah, that's a good idea. But if we're going to put in an extra 10 or 20 or 30% more hours, we should be paid more. And so I really think that you didn't answer the question, first of all. And second of all, I think that, you know, money is a more of an important issue than what you're willing to admit it. I would like to see either a yes or no.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, of course, Mr. Bartholomew knows that you do have to use the implicit price deflator rather than the CPI for funding like education if you're going to be honest, according to the economists. But in any case, that's not what I was raising my hand for. I don't still have my sheet that you passed out yesterday. I had it yesterday. But on the back, you said something about, I would love to see it. Thank you very much. You're such a nice guy. I'd love to fire with Mr. Bartholomew. It says, as you consider House File 501, ask how lowering high school expectations will address the following disparities. And then you're talking about the disparities in students of color graduating compared to students that who are white and the achievement gap and so forth. And so my question for you is how not having a grace period for this change test, and over two-thirds of our high school graduates may fail to graduate, will help with these things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, I think one of the concerns we have with House File 501 and not requiring students to pass is the message that we're not serious about the expectations we've set, and we're coming up to a spot. As one of the people who spoke at one of your earlier meetings said, you know, part of their premise was statewide exit exams don't have much of an impact on student achievement. And one of the reasons he said for that was because every time we start to get to the point where there are going to be some consequences to our expectations, states almost without exclusion have always said, well, let's back down and lower our expectations so everybody can make it. I think part of our experience with the BSTs is 12 years ago, you heard that the basic skills tests were too hard. They weren't a realistic expectation for high school students. Too many kids aren't going to be able to pass them. And looking back 12 years later now, I don't know that many people would argue that the BSTs are too hard and too much of an expectation for high school students. And I think also yesterday there were some comments, is it fair to students not to give them a diploma? The flip side to that argument is it fair to students to give them a diploma when we know they don't have the preparation they need to succeed, either going on to a post-secondary education or looking for work? I've got a story of an experience I had in another job, but suffice it to say it was a group.
We are going to need to move this along because we do want to get to a vote.
I won't get into the story, but Representative Dreiling, I guess the answer is we can either choose to give them a diploma when we know they don't have the skills and they won't. They'll spend time and money in post-secondary institutions not completing a program, or they'll try to get a job and find that they can't get or keep the job because they don't have the preparation. In short, they won't find a lot of success even though they got a diploma. Or we can truly describe what kids need to know at the end of high school, stick with it, try to find out what they need to be successful, and when they do get a diploma, then they are prepared.
At this time, I'd like to bring down Stacia Smith as well. She has some comments she would like to add. If you'd please state your name for the record and give your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Stacia Smith, and I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is the largest business advocacy organization in the state, representing over 2,700 members. First up, I want to very much thank Chair Mariani for giving us the opportunity to talk this morning. I know it would have been better if we could have just passed the bill last night, but or yesterday morning, but I appreciate the opportunity to give this testimony. The Minnesota Chamber supports changes to the education system that would improve student results. Our ultimate goal is to ensure that Minnesota has a world-class workforce. The Chamber believes that Minnesota's economic competitiveness depends on its school system producing a highly educated and skilled workforce. While many students in Minnesota perform well on U.S. standardized tests and graduate on time, it is clear that an increasingly unacceptable number of students leave the K-12 system unprepared for higher education or the workforce. These shortcomings will have a negative impact on the state's workforce and ultimately our economy. The grad test that we're talking about today, I first want to clarify a couple of things that have been discussed yesterday morning and this morning. The test was written by Minnesota teachers. It's aligned to Minnesota's English and math standards that were passed, that this legislature has discussed, and implemented in 2004 when the class of 2010 was in the sixth grade. It's my understanding that this test does not include Algebra 2, calculus, trigonometry, or anything like that. Only Algebra 1 is the highest level. It's also my understanding that we do not know how many students will or will not pass this test because it has not been administered yet. The legislation being discussed today would turn a blind eye to many students that demonstrate they are not ready to graduate. We do not know how many students this will impact yet, and I would encourage this committee to wait until the students have taken the test to make any determination as to whether or not this legislation is necessary. It might be the case that it is necessary to come to some kind of short-term solution, but the bottom line is we don't know yet. So I would urge you to oppose House File 501.
All right, members, I'm going to ask, as we have a list of questions here as well as to our testifiers, please keep your answers brief as we do need to move along. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up with some things that were said earlier and by Mr. Bartholomew, and part of that is we're not lowering standards, and that was said numerous times. Our standards are staying the same, so I just want to clear that up. We're not lowering our standards. The standards remain exactly the same. This is this bill is a short-term solution, so we're still on target for the standards. It's a short-term solution. And to the Chamber's comments, I totally agree. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, and we don't know what cut score should be used, and so we should wait. I totally agree with you before we make a decision, but what we should wait on is keeping our students from graduating because we don't know. We need to give it a year or two till we find out what the results are, and then, of course, we'll make adjustments and raise our expectations with regard to graduation as we go. And I think this bill addresses everything the two of you just said by finding a short-term solution to a problem that we are foreseeing.
Mr. Chair,
briefly, yes.
Norton, just quickly, because the standards are still there. We just aren't requiring students to demonstrate competency on the grad to show that they've met the standards. We aren't enforcing them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, I would just add to your comment that students haven't taken the test yet under any motivating factor. And if they think they have to take the test to graduate, I think we might see very different results than taking the test without any requirement to graduate. And I would also reinforce that I think the sufficient time to pass legislation and the 2010 session to rectify this issue if it turns out there is an issue, because at this point we don't really know.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Faust brought up the topic about the practice test again, and I'm wondering if the department could give a brief explanation about the practice test again, because I think there's some misunderstanding about that. And then while they're coming down, is this the time that you'd want to have comments on the bill, or would I do that again later?
We can do comments now on that as well.
Well, I'm just trying to speed things up.
But yeah, just try to, and yeah. We are too.
I guess what I'd like to say as far as this bill goes, I agree with the short-term fix. I just would really like to see a long-term solution incorporated within the bill. I understand this is going to finance, and I'm hoping that Representative Greiling will be willing to hear any comments about any changes for long-term solutions in her committee.
Dr. Mattson, I and I officially call it to order as well.
Mr. Chair, members, this is Mattson, Director of Research and Assessment for the department. The item sampler that was discussed yesterday and shown is the MCA2 item sampler. It is a paper-based item sampler. The items on there are a number of items that are common to both assessments, but it is not the item sampler for the grad. The grad is actually an online assessment, and as such, the item sampler or the practice test is actually delivered online. So we have those items available on computer, and students respond to them online. To the point also, the standards are, the grad is a subset of items that are on the MCA2. So there certainly are common items between the two, but Minnesota teachers, as was mentioned, identified the standards they wanted covered on the grad that was sent for public comment during our test specification development, and then finally identified as that subset that now those items and those benchmarks are identified on our website as well.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the comments that Mr. Bartholomew made, I certainly agree with you that we should have a very high standard for graduation, and that I think it is a disservice to give diplomas to students that are not ready for the job market or for college. I agree with you. But where I disagree very strongly is that I do not believe this test is the right measure to determine that. And that's, I think, where my strongest disagreement with you is because, I mean, when 37% of the students pass the test, there's a problem with the test.
All right, and I'm going to take that as a comment. Mr. Representative Swell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just would like to comment that I also believe in rigorous teaching. I believe in high standards, and I also know that high schools have graduation requirements that they still hold their students to, regardless of whether this bill passes or does not pass. And I think school boards and teaching staff all want to hold their students accountable to curriculum and to the requirements that have been set long ago and continued, I think, to improve. I'm going to talk a little bit about the what ifs. What if this bill, this amendment, does not pass? And part of me feels that we need to think of two words called class action. I know parents very, very well, particularly teaching in the gifted area. We talk about helicopter parents. If this provision goes in, I think we're going to have Apache helicopter parents, because they will not be happy. And I know that there are students who do not come on into their own because of maturation problems, all kinds of issues, until they get a little bit older. I am not wanting to lower standards by any means, but as I stated yesterday, when we have a scaffolded curriculum which begins in first grade or kindergarten, and we build on those skills, we are not going to see evidence of that until those younger grades make it into middle school and high school. Just because these standards were embedded in sixth grade does not mean that those students benefited from the scaffolding that really begins in kindergarten. So we're asking for some breathing space, and I certainly am not looking forward to the day when I walk into my high school and these helicopter parents descend. I'm going to go for cover.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would also like to add to Representative Swell's comments. Something else that this committee has not talked about, and I wish it was part of the long-term solution, as Representative McFarland indicated, is communication. I, for one, as a parent of three teenage boys, did not realize that our state had changed direction and that now we had a math test that was going to be required to be passed in order to get a high school diploma. Now, I've mentioned that in several different venues, and they have the blame goes to my school district. I've asked my school district, where have we communicated that? And there are some lines in some very heavily texted communications home that I would say the average parent misses. And I feel so strongly that to implement this test is that I bet 50, 60% of the parents of this state would be totally surprised. I realize there are people that think I'm wrong on that and that we should be blaming the school districts, but I think that is the reality. And so my position is that as a part of the long-term solution to this, we need to start communicating with parents in third, fourth, fifth grade that your child has to stay on track in math so that they can get their diploma when they graduate from high school. I don't think that's the conversation we've had with parents in this state. If we have, I think it is random. I think it is in very archaic forms. When Representative Swales and myself went to Arkansas to look at their system, they had a PR system going out to parents during their drive time on the radio about what kind of classes should their kids be enrolling in for college success. They had a strong message that every child needs to be prepared for college. On cable TV, I mean, I think we have sorely missed a major piece to any major implementation of a grad standard. And I just feel so bad about that, and I wish that we could get to the point again where we thought it was okay to talk to the public and to give them such real firm expectations and instead of calling it political because it's a political message. Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I blame the school board and all that Newton guy, you know. Anyway, and actually, it does, just to help people understand this thing, I read this letter from the chamber, and I read the partnership thing, and this committee agrees. We are in angst about these outcomes, as are you, and deservedly so. And but I, Representative Newton, then council member Newton, and I debated our first campaign together. I was against the profile, he was for it. We were both for high standards. We thought we were both doing the right thing. And we were at polar opposites. I think the message that I just hope that you all hear from us and the members of the committee focus on is that, you know, we had some testimony yesterday from some very well-intended, just normal citizens running schools saying, we are very nervous about what's going to happen. We've seen evidence. We think there's a bridge out. You might want to know that. And and so you take your foot off the gas, maybe you take a little different route, and I want to point out that a moving bill creates dialogue. A bill sitting quietly does not. I'll predict that this bill, if any of this bill becomes law, it'll be different in every word than what we're going to pass out of here today. But I just hope people don't take whatever the vote turns out today to be a political statement we're for or against standards. We want our kids learning. We want our kids to get the same exact accomplishments you want them. We want people to get change at the McDonald's window and know what a quarter difference means and not be confused by that, and to pass the test and to succeed in a global thing. So we all want that. And so I hope that as this bill moves, and I hope it moves out today, and I hope that Station, Jim, you're part of the debate, and the department, and Carlos, and the rest of the members are earnestly saying, how are we going to help these students to learn, and how are we going to not get them discouraged and achieve the high outcomes we all want? I guess that's a comment, not a question, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Just a quick comment on that, and a couple of the comments earlier. Totally know that the committee's committed to high standards for all. But I think part of the concern is what you have before you today is a bill that for the foreseeable future exempt the requirement from students being able to demonstrate competency on those standards. And we don't see any, what we'd love to see is, I think Representative McFarland mentioned it, there's some connection between a short-term strategy and a long-term strategy. Right now, all you have before you is a strategy that says for the foreseeable future, there's no accountability for achievement, with no long-term vision for what's going to be there.
Which was noted earlier, and we're going to move on to two further questions. Representative Downey.
Actually, not a question, Mr. Chairman, but my comments on the bill. I'm going to, as much as I am in favor of providing some kind of a grace period and some kind of strategy to get to where we need to be, I'm going to vote against this bill for that exact reason, that there isn't the long-term strategy there. And just a couple observations that I've had as I've been sitting here listening to the debate that I think warrant further discussion here in this committee. We talked about fairness, and I think there's another fairness equation, and that's the fairness to the kids who actually do the work and can pass the standard and are not differentiated from those who can't. I think there's another dimension to fairness there that we're not talking about. And an overriding observation, I think we've heard many comments that we can't change the system until we start at the beginning and follow those changes all the way through. And just from a systems thinking perspective, I mean, I hear us talking about concepts that Deming and others have had, and it seems like we're still locked into an industrial model in K-12 education. If we want to improve the output of our education system, and the only way we can do that is to start before kindergarten and follow something all the way through, we're literally 12 to 15 years away from any improvement in education if we buy that thinking. And that's really an industrial output kind of model thinking. And, you know, I know Bill Gates talks about blowing up the K-12 system and starting over. I've never been a proponent of that. But if, in fact, our only way to affect change and to improve outcomes for these kids and to prepare them better is to start, you know, with 12 years lead time, I think our system is failing those kids. So I'd urge us to think within the education establishment about how we affect change more rapidly as compared to that industrial model. And we've heard some criticisms of No Child Left Behind and the intensity of these measurement systems. And I'll go back to the comments of the professor from Michigan State who really challenged us not to back off of those standards. We're having this discussion today, and we're having a great discussion kind of throughout this session in this committee because we do have these measures and we now have some accountabilities, and those wouldn't be there if we didn't adopt these standards and impose these tests on ourselves. So I would argue that we not back off, that we would increase our sense of urgency and find ways to implement these changes more rapidly in our education system. And with that, I'll pass it over to somebody else for comments.
Thank you, Representative Downey, and I would challenge you to take a look and examine the concepts of scope and sequence, which is not an industrial term within an archaic education system. It's very strong standard and a strong effective practice to say that when you're looking at the concept of education and how it is that we educate youth, that we do have to have a scope, and there needs to be a sequence of how we introduce concepts and ideals to kids and how they're going to be tested on that. So I would say to look into that as you start to look at the conversation about a holistic approach to systemic change to education and how it is that we're going to deliver that to our children. So look at that in the concept of how it is to turn this vehicle around within 2 to 6 years. But Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with Representative Downey to the effect that we have to change the system. And I think one of the ways we can change the system is to have an end-of-course exam that's designed by the state. So when the students finish Algebra 1, they take a test at that time, not 6 months later, not sometime down the road when they haven't had the course, and then all of a sudden we have to pull all of our resources in school together to prepare kids for a test. We have to stop the education process in order to prepare them for a test. So what I would like to see, rather than a standalone grad test, is an end-of-course test. If indeed this is an Algebra 1 test and it's at that level, then let's do the testing at the time that the students finish Algebra 1. If they don't pass it, they can take Algebra 1 again and take the test one more time. But that gives you plenty of time, because In our middle schools, we're now requiring the students to take Algebra 1 at the end of 8th grade, or in 8th grade. So, I'd like to see a systemic change, but a logical systemic change, and not just for math. If we're going to do it for science, if we're going to do it for English, let's have a state test that provides the vehicle for measuring at that time. Thank you.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just make a brief comment, but it's been mentioned that there's no long-term solution in this bill, and I believe there is. If you look at the establishment of the stakeholders group that's intended to look at the research, the amendment has this group examining high-stakes tests, and I think even while the end-of-course exam might be an interesting alternative, I'm not willing to go to that without looking much further at what the research tells us. We've committed as a committee to being research-based, data-driven, and I don't believe this exam warrants that kind of endorsement by this committee, because I don't think we have the research base to say that this high-stakes exam at this point is the right choice for assessing the standards as our students are moving toward them. Our students work on a daily basis toward these standards, and we know very clearly from testing theory that formative assessment is a much stronger shaper of student knowledge and skills than summative assessment. And I think we need to assess the relationship between these tools and not put so much weight on a single summative assessment.
At this time, I'd like to call down Ralph Maves, who would like to testify, and then we'll open it up to if there are any public testifiers, and then proceed.
Good morning. My name is Ralph Mays. I'm a retired psychologist who spent 36 years working in the public schools. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to make some comments which I think are appropriate to the discussion. Dr. William Sanders, the gentleman who spoke to this House Education Policy Committee several years ago regarding value-added assessments, has been quoted as stating the following: when you talk about accountability standards, you're not talking about education standards. You're talking about political decisions. As a statistician, if you tell me what percentage of kids you want to fail, I can tell you where to put the cut scores. An example of how this played out in one state is Arizona. In 2002, the state, and I'm not quoting Dr. Sanders at this point, I'm quoting myself. As an example of how this played out in one state is Arizona. In 2002, the state of Arizona was going to implement their high-stakes graduation exit exams called the AIMS test. However, they moved the implementation date back to 2006 because so many students were failing the test. In the spring of 2005, they were still in a quandary because one-third of the juniors still had not passed one or more of the AIMS tests. There was talk, among other things, of issuing two diplomas, one for those who had passed the test and one for those who had not. What did they finally do? They changed the cut score so that only, and I put only in quotes, only 10% of the students were denied a diploma rather than one-third. Data provided here at the legislature this year indicated a dropout rate for high school students of just over 14%. My information from my studies suggests that for those states that have exit exams, high stakes exit exams, approximately 10% of the students do not receive diplomas, in addition to those who drop out. If the same figure were to apply to Minnesota, this would mean that approximately 1 in 4 high school students who enter 9th grade would leave without a diploma. We are told we should leave no student behind, that we should prepare all students for the 21st century, that we should prepare all students for the global economy. What I do not understand is how having 1 in 4 of our students each year not receiving a diploma is not leaving them behind, is preparing them for functioning adequately in the 21st century, and is adequately preparing them to function in the global economy. Related to this point, I do not hear from the governor's office, from the legislature, or from the business community their plans to help these students who are wandering around without a diploma. I would love to hear that discussion. Second, high-stakes exit exams are put in place, we are told, so diplomas mean something. We are further told that a student passing these exams should be better prepared for college, for the workforce, for the military,
than those who do not pass these exams. Most states which have put these exams in place have done nothing to validate that these exams do what they purport to do. And for those states which have done studies, the results are not encouraging. The state of Ohio, for example, has had the exam since 1994 and has done no studies to validate these exams. The state of New York has had the Regents exams for many years, and the only thing they can tell you at this point is the scores are higher now than they used to be. The state of Massachusetts did a study to examine the number of their high school graduates who were taking remedial courses in college prior to the use of the exit exams in that state compared to the number of high school graduates from that state who were taking remedial courses in college after the exams were put in place. There was no statistical difference. The state of Texas did the same kind of study and found there were actually more students taking remedial courses in college after the exit exams were put in place than before. We talk about accountability so often in our country and our state. Students should be accountable, parents should be accountable, teachers should be accountable, administrators should be accountable. Why should states not be accountable? Why should states which put high stakes exit exams in place not be called upon to show that these exams are doing what the states indicate they will do? How can we deny diplomas to students based on their not passing exams, which we, quote, think, unquote, are valid measures of what they purport to measure, but for which we have no meaningful research evidence to support our beliefs? That is not rigor, and that's not accountability, tenets we hold so dear for our students. Third, in my opinion, there's really no reason to have high-stakes exit exams unless one feels that's the only way to motivate students to perform well. One could give students exams during their senior year in high school in reading, math, and written language, and then record the scores on the students' transcripts along with the passing scores. That information would be available to any college admission officer, personnel director, military recruiting officer, or anyone else with a need to know. At my last check, the states surrounding Minnesota do not administer high-stakes exit exams to students for graduation. These include Iowa, the Dakotas, Montana, Nebraska, Kansas, Missouri, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin. I would have to assume that these states consider their graduates as ready to compete in the 21st century as those graduates of states which have high-stakes exit exams. That's a hard comment to say. In New York State, there's a consortium of 28 high schools which have had their students excused from taking the Regents exam. This is because the students from these high schools have done so well in post-high school activities. One follow-up study found 77% of the consortium school graduates attending four-year colleges, 17% attending two-year colleges, and 4% attending vocational technical programs. This is quite an accomplishment for students who came from high schools which have more students of color, more students who qualify for free or reduced price lunch, more students receiving special education services, and more entering 9th and 10th grade students scoring below the state standard on reading and math tests than the average New York City high school. Perhaps Minnesota needs to study what these schools are doing so well. We so often hear how well students from other countries or foreign educational systems do in comparison to the United States. These places include Finland, Sweden, the United Kingdom, Hong Kong. None of these require students to pass high-stakes exit exams to graduate from high school. Again, perhaps we in Minnesota need to study how they are approaching the education of their students. I just might add that when international test data is disaggregated, which seems to be a term that we like to throw around nowadays, and students living in poverty are factored out, U.S. students do very well in comparison to students of other nations. The elephant in the room appears to be poverty and not inferior teaching or lack of rigor in the United States schools. You don't often hear this mentioned. In concluding, I would like to predict that if high-stakes exit exams are put into place in Minnesota, the following scenario will play out. After several years, the Minnesota legislature will ask for a study to be done to see how things are proceeding with regard to the exams. The results will be as follows. There is no data to indicate that students who pass the exams are doing significantly better in college or the workforce than students did before the exams were put into place. Two, that many students are being harmed by being denied a diploma. And three, that the vast majority of students being harmed because of being denied a diploma are students of color, ethnic minority students, and students living in poverty. And before I close, I would just like to encourage any members of this committee who have not had a chance to look at the data that's been collected by the department on who is passing and who's not passing the basic skills test, I think it would be informative. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Representative Mariani, any closing comments on the bill before we go to a vote?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have testify on some other bills, so I'm going to cut this very short. I think this committee did an excellent job of talking through and making the major points that I think need to be made here. I do want to correct, however, just a factual error on Mr. Bartholomew's presentation. We're not talking about making changes to the reading grad. The issue here is the math grad test. Members, let me just also encourage us to, quite frankly, cease and desist from using sort of the rhetorical weapon that any of us, Democrats or Republicans, executive branch or legislative branch, the members, are out to lower standards in the state of Minnesota. I've served here for a number of years, and believe me, there is unanimity in this body around high and rigorous standards. The real question before us is how do we fairly and equitably and realistically, intelligently measure our success and our learning environments relative to those new higher standards. That's really the evolutionary edge I think that we're at. Members, I want to remind you, the commissioner can currently set the cut score anywhere she wants. Now, obviously, she's going to be very responsible for with that, but the data right now is showing us that she's going to have to reach pretty darn low. Based on the data, no one knows what the test result's going to be, but based on the data of testing that leads up to this spring test, the intelligent projection is she's going to have to set that really low in order to avoid literally thousands of Minnesota seniors not receiving a diploma next year. Arguably, that could be called lowering the standard. We're not leveling that charge. We're just saying that let's do no harm. Let's buy ourselves a little bit of time. We absolutely have school systems that are teaching to those standards. There are multiple ways in which we can measure the efficacy of our teaching and learning. We need to develop that new generation of measurement aligned to those high standards. Even the governor in his letter isn't arguing, if you read it carefully, isn't arguing against the short-term fix. The governor basically wants a long-term quid pro quo to put on the table in exchange for that. So even the executive branch is recognizing in some way the importance of us doing no harm. There is lots of common ground here. If we keep our heads, we keep this bill moving. The governor's proposal on dealing with the long-term solution is going to require millions of dollars of new funding for testing. I don't need to remind anybody here that the state simply does not have that money. Nonetheless, it's appropriate for us, in my opinion, to move this bill onto the K-12 Finance Committee where we can, in fact, debate and see what we can work out relative to the governor's proposal, which does require millions of more dollars to be put into testing. And, you know, we're all, if we're inspired, if we're not yelling and pointing fingers at each other, we can resolve this. So, members, with that, I renew my motion that House File 501 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee with a recommendation that it be referred to the K-12 Finance Committee.
Representative Mariani renews his motion that House File 501, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance with a further recommendation that it be referred to the K-12 Education Finance Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And now we will invite down Representative Carlson for House File 466.
Mr. Representative Carlson, welcome to the committee that you so ably chaired for a number of years, and it was my privilege and honor to serve on as a member of your committee during those years.
Well, thank you. I chaired one education committee or another for about 20 years, so have a long history with some of the issues. And Mr. Chairman, it was difficult to sit in the audience and not want to chime in on your last discussion. And in fact, I did get a chance to share a few thoughts with you on the side there.
Representative Carlson, the chair will move House File 466, the recommended to pass and lead over for possible inclusion into our education policy bill, omnibus policy bill.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, just a quick walk through when your staff communicated with us, they indicated that they would like me to keep it to about 10 minutes, so I'll have that goal in mind. This is a bill that would reestablish the State Board of Education in the state of Minnesota. And just to walk you through the bill, and the membership of the board would consist of 12 citizens, at least one from each congressional district, and at least four that have been elected school board members. We would also include the Minsky Chancellor or the Chancellor's designee, as well as the President of the University of Minnesota or the President's designee. The Governor appoints members with the advice and consent of the Senate. There's an annual meeting required to be held in August. Compensation would be the same as for other administrative boards, but that means basically per diem and transportation costs. Section 2 reinstates the powers of the Board of Education, removing them from the Commissioner of Education, including the authority to supervise educational agencies and adopt and amend administrative rules. In essence, what that's doing is reestablishing the powers that the State Board of Education had in the past. And if you've had a chance, by the way, to look over Lisa Larson's memos, you know that we had, under various names and various structures, what I would call the State Board of Education back to 1913. Minnesota and Wisconsin are the only two states with no State Board of Education. And interestingly enough, one of my main points for wanting to see a State Board reestablished is the opportunity for public input. And there is one big difference between Wisconsin and Minnesota, even though neither are a State Board of Education. In the case of Wisconsin, the Commissioner of Education, or whatever the title is elected. Mm-hmm. So that's a vehicle, if you would, for public input. Public education is the largest and most important activity of state government and one of the few constitutionally mandated roles of state government. And as I pointed out, if we reestablish it, it would ensure public access. And it brings informed statewide citizen perspective to education, and it provides stability and long-term vision for a results-oriented public education system. The other point that I would make, and if I were, you know, after all, something that often happens, this morning when I came in earlier, there was one thing that was missing, and part of the argument that I've made for a state board, and when I chaired the Education Committee, I actually had a subcommittee that was appointed that just began their work, and then we had went through a transition majority to minority, and they called it the Transition Subcommittee, and I was very interested in bringing early education, K-12, and higher education together, and hence this model, we've included higher education, but if the bill were to move forward, Mr. Chairman, I would like to suggest that the bill be amended in a way that would include someone with a background from early childhood education as well to serve on the board. I didn't happen to have an amendment prepared to do that today, but I would make that suggestion as it moves forward, if you so desire. Just one other final point. There are a variety of models across the United States. The first model, the governor appoints the state board. The board then appoints the chief state school officer. That was essentially the model that we at one time had in Minnesota years ago, and 12 states still have that model. A second model is where you have an elected state board, and the board appoints the chief school officer, and 8 states have that. A third model, the governor appoints the state board independently. They appoint the state board, and then the commissioner is elected independently, and 11 states have that model. And a fourth model is the governor appoints the state board and the chief state school officer. Then there's the fifth model, of which we're a part of, Minnesota and Wisconsin, where we don't have any state board. By the way, this was a Senate initiative years ago. It was not a House position. I'll point that out. And it was one of those things that came about, if I recall correctly, in conference committee and in a bipartisan way. We have attempted to reestablish from a House perspective on more than one occasion the State Board of Education. So I would hope that the bill could move forward and that we could reestablish the board for the reasons cited. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Questions, Representative Greiling, Peterson, and Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I just want to thank Representative Carlson for bringing this bill forward. I'm the second author. I strongly supported. I was on the conference committee back in 1998 when the Senate prevailed. And the reason that they did, I think, was a very unfair reason to the Board of Education. We, the legislature, assigned them many hot potatoes that we were too chicken-hearted as a body to deal with, such as the diversity rule, the integration rule, the profile of learning. And they were given those assignments by legislators who didn't want to deal with them themselves. And then when they came forward with the results of the assignment they were given, we said, why are they bringing these things to us? They must be off the track or something. And so so then that was part of the catalyst for getting rid of them in the first place. And so we only had ourselves to blame. And now we only have ourselves to blame that we keep trying to recreate them. We had a advisory committee for looking at charter schools that this committee decided we didn't want, rightly so, and we took it out. But that used to be the State Board of Education that looked at all those things, the charter schools. We have the Office of Educational Accountability because we don't want the state board, the department, to do everything because we think they're too political. The State Board of Education wasn't so political. They did not always agree with the governor. They were even better, as Representative Carlson said, when the governor didn't appoint their head. And the next bill we have is yet another attempt to reinstate the Board of Education. I would say, why don't we just go back to having the Board of Education like all other states? We tried not being the Department of Education. We were Children, Families, and Learning. We tried not to have a Board of Education. Let's have one again and support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greiling. And I was a part of that legislature as well. It was a very painful period of time, and I believe your assessment is absolutely correct. And I think we can point the fingers right back at ourselves as a body for not counting to 10 properly. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, Representative Greiling answered my first question, was why it was voted out in 1998, and I wondered about the political ramifications. I guess just one other question that I would have, which will probably come up to Representative Carlson as this goes through, and this board would be appointed by the governor and, yes, approved by the Senate. And I hear so much controversy about the Met Council being appointed by the governor, and I'm wondering if you're going to run this, and the need, by at least felt by many people, that would be elected body to represent the, in some way, the cities and counties. So are you going to run into some of that same kind of controversy with having the governor appoint these members of the board?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, there are other models out there. I listed a few of them. There is at least one state, maybe more, that actually the state board is appointed by the legislature. And then, as I mentioned, there is the model where state board members are elected. What I attempted to do with this particular bill was put in place what we had in the past, which seemed to work quite well. But there are other models that that could be used. I had less experience with those. I've had experience with this one. And I don't think it's been particularly problematic historically that the governor has appointed people for those positions. And then you do have, by the way, a couple who would not be appointed by the governor who would be playing a role there, and that would be the president of the University of Minnesota and the Chancellor of the Minsky system.
Representative Abrams.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson, it's just ironic that we're in this room and you're bringing this bill forward. I don't remember in 1999 or thereabouts when freshman Abler was trying to reinstate the board over the desires of Senator Olson. And I never heard of the term delete all amendment before. And my bill came forward, and I think you served on GovOps at the time. And this amendment plunked down. I'd worked on establishing the, whatever the board should do, trying to restate it. And then I don't remember what your amendment was, but it just seems to have brought back a memory. And actually, you prevailed. And I left a very startled, surprised freshman with the bill that was much shorter than I'd come in with. And and the representative mayor said, well, at least you still have a vehicle. And so I didn't recognize the make and model of the vehicle, but it was... I don't have such a delete all amendment prepared today, Representative Carlson, but I do have a question. So I remember that whole time.
Well, Dave, can I comment to your first comment?
Sure.
My recollection of that was we were attempting to reestablish the board, and Harry Mayers and I, at that point, he was chair of the Education Committee, and I think I was perhaps the ranking member because I was in the minority at that point. And we did form a cross-the-aisle coalition to attempt to reestablish the state board. I think that's what we were doing with your bill. So it's actually been on the House side, mainly bipartisan, to reestablish it. But, yeah, we did try to make some adjustments in government office. I remember that.
Yeah, and it was a shock to the freshmen. They didn't know what was coming. So some of these bipartisan plans don't include the author. But it was just a...
Those were the best
part of the
plan. Anyway, it was minority at that point.
It worked, you know. Yeah. And it was just kind of an interesting time. You learn a lot.
Perhaps
you
can call former Representative
Mayors. Yeah, I'll ask. Anyway, but just a question about the, and I don't know if this is a good idea or not anymore. I haven't even thought about it for a while, so I'll have to listen to the testimony. But would there be a fiscal cost, I would expect? And why would this be part of a policy omnibus and not part of the education omnibus? Whoever wants to answer that.
Well, in terms of how it proceeds, yes, there is a minor cost. There is language in there that would state that board members would, in essence, as I mentioned in my presentation, receive per diem and transportation costs. I would advocate to do that. I did, in my early days in the legislature, I served on a health board where there was, by law, no compensation. Wasn't a big issue for me because we met in the metropolitan area and I was able to commute over without a great expense, but it would create a bit of a problem, I think, for people coming in from rural Minnesota if they had to serve without any compensation and had transportation and other expenses while they were in town. And we treat them the same as any other board that we have, but there would be a minor cost.
And just the other thing, then I'm done. As the cobwebs come off my brain now from working on this over a decade ago, the duties of what they're supposed to do is really the devil in the details, and that's where the work would come. And so, well, good luck with you anyway. I just wanted to
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And actually, Representative Abler's last comment is kind of the source of my question. I'm curious, moving from an executive to a board oversight, how does
thank you, Representative Dodd. I'm sorry, we're just trying to clarify.
That's totally fine.
Technical issues. Yeah.
Excuse me. There was a little conversation there about the next stop for the bill.
So, just as maybe one practical matter, how does budgeting and then financial accountability work within this model, and how does that kind of translate to accountability to local school boards as well? I mean, you can see a nice, tight, crisp line of authority to the governor through the chief executive, if you will, the current commissioner. How do those things work in this new model or in this old model?
Well, the Mr. Chairman, if I'm understanding your question, the chief executive officer, or in the case of Minnesota, the commissioner would be the one providing the staffing, if that's where you're heading. Those costs would be inherent in the Department of Education. St- State Department still carries the appropriation for the various boards and commissions. If you're asking about the per diem and that kind of thing, that's where that would be carried. Things wouldn't change in terms of the flow of dollars that are administered by the department, and we set the formulas and so on in terms of the distribution to school districts, if that was part of your question.
If I could, so the commissioner essentially, thank you, Mr. Chairman, the commissioner essentially reports to the board instead of the governor, is that really the model?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't change in this particular proposal. At one time, the appointment process for the commissioner, actually last session I had two versions of the bill. I had one version where we went back to what we had prior to the first perfect years of governor, and board appointed the commissioner. My assumption, and the reason I'm promoting this bill, leaving that in place where the governor continues to appoint the commissioner, I'm assuming, although I haven't had a conversation with the governor, that most governors don't like to give up an appointment like that. So I thought some middle ground would be the reestablishing of the board and allowing the governor to continue to appoint the commissioner. I personally, if I had my way and I didn't have to worry about whether the governor would want to give up an appointment or not, I think the best system, and it was less political, was when the board actually appointed the commissioner. Even though it was done by a governor on my side of the aisle, when Perpich made that recommendation, I quite honestly at the time was very concerned that it might politicize the commissioner's role, and I'm not saying anything about the current commissioner, but I could give you a couple of examples in the past where it became very politicized in terms of the commissioner and the role of the commissioner the role the commissioner had with the governor at the time, and it became politicized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just from the budgeting and funding standpoint, the budget process runs currently as it is today. The legislature makes the appropriations, but it is the board and in conjunction with the commissioner who set the budget and then execute it. Is that a fair statement?
What aspect of the budget, Mr. Chairman, are you referring to? The actual budget of the department?
Correct. The establishment of it and the presentation.
I would, Mr. Chairman, as other boards have a role, I would see a role of the board in establishing the department budget, yes.
Members, I want to move quickly. We've got a couple of members asking questions, and we still need to take testimony from the public. Representative Flowers.
Thank you. Two quick points. Representative Carlson, thank you for offering to include early childhood. I'd like to work with you on that, I hope. And then the second point is on Representative Peterson's point about politicizing the appointments. You know, recently the governor appointed an early childhood advisory council, and we'd like to think that's not political, but we had a member that has threatened to quit over the lack of diversity of the people that were appointed. So while we would like to think that things come out the way they're supposed to, we have a very recent example that it didn't work, and this is a person of high standing that works for the University of Minnesota, so I think we need to be careful. And along those lines, I hope at some point you would consider model number 3 of electing the commissioner. I think that potentially would be a better model. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bloom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's my involvement with education in Minnesota really occurred after this board was eliminated, so I'm only, you know, familiar with how things are operating now without it. But Representative Carlson, if you could just perhaps expound a little bit on how you feel the creation of this board or bringing it back would be ultimately better for kids and our educational system here in Minnesota. I think we all strive to want to do things that ultimately are what's good for kids and for education, and removing that from a politicized environment I think is a good goal. But on the other hand, I think realistically we're all here, and government really is the outgrowth of a political process. So I think we have to be a little bit realistic, and I'm wondering how this is going to do that, and how with the advisory boards and that and councils that exist currently within our educational structure, how this is going to be different.
Representative Carlson.
Chairman, I'm a strong advocate of citizen involvement and citizen input. And I've tried to do two things the way this board would be structured. One is to make sure you have people that have had experience on a board. And so we would require, as I pointed out, a minimum of four of the board members having served as a school board member. The others would be citizens, and it would be citizen input. I think the best model that I can give you is your local school board, you know, where you have a school board, people elected by the citizens of the community that have oversight and involvement with the policy of the local school district. We lack that citizen input at the state level. And as I pointed out, we're one of the very few states that don't provide for that one way or the other. And I think education is well served when you do have a group of citizens that are there providing input, and I think that you would probably strengthen the educational system overall in the state of Minnesota if you had that at the highest level.
Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think this is an interesting proposal. Just from a broad perspective, I have concerns, and I guess like Representative Abler mentioned, I haven't thought about this before, and I wasn't here when we had a Board of Education, so a State Board of Education, so I'm interested. Concerns I have, however, Representative Carlson, another layer of government, number one. We have one more inserted layer. And just real quickly to your point about having citizens involved, I think we are citizens. And we are former school board members, and we are former teachers. And I think to separate us as something different than citizens and to say that we aren't involved in this at a detailed level, I think is maybe missing something, because we are citizens. So I'm concerned about another layer. Number two, about the issue of make it too political. This board, being appointed by the governor, other than the two from the Minsky system and the University of Minnesota, having the appointments come, to say that and subsequent approval by the Senate would not be political, I think, is a bit naive. I think it would be very political. We have processes in place to appoint lots of boards, including the Board of Regents of the state of Minnesota, University of Minnesota. And we find over time that pretty soon we introduce legislation that says, well, now we're going to make sure we have a board member of this type and a board member of that type. And then we have a process in place that really doesn't matter when it comes to the final vote, because then things change anyway. So to say that this is going to be a non-political process, I think, might be that's a bit naive and maybe even a little deceiving. So those are concerns I have. I would not see those as reasons to do this. And the last thing I would say is I don't see any stated purpose for them, what they would be doing other than general oversight. And so I look forward to getting more detail about what it is that this Board of Citizens would do that is being inserted in between, it appears to me, in between the legislature and the Department of Education. And I'm not sure what that relationship would be. I'm not sure who would do what. So those are just general concerns I have that I would have to have answered and be able to come to some sort of a rational... I just need to be settled myself with some of those questions as we move forward with this. Thank you.
Chairman, just one thing that I would point out, yes, the legislature is a citizen group made up of a variety of individuals, but it's a separate branch of government. What we're talking about here is creating a state board of education where you would have, I would argue, both professional and citizen input into the state board of education and various policies that are now done basically solely by the commissioner and the commissioner's staff without any direct public input. So I think there's a fundamental difference there when we talk legislature and the administrative branch.
Thank you. Representative Zepke, and if there's anyone in the audience that wishes to testify in the show, if they can... If there's anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on the bill, please come forward. Representative Zepke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson, I do need to ask you this question because very often when someone brings forward a change such as this, there are lots of different reasons for it, and you've expressed your reasons very, very carefully. And
excuse me.
go ahead. We're talking a little history here of who may not have been authors of the bills to establish the state board.
I also was not here when the other state board was here, and my question is, is one of the reasons that you're bringing this forward, is it that you are in any way displeased with the current job that the current commissioner is doing?
The answer to that is no. And when I referenced the political, the politics I said I could give you examples in the past. If I had problems with the current commissioner, I would probably have my other version before you, we would create a state board, and the state board would appoint the commissioner. I don't have that before you. Besides that, when I chaired the Education Committee, Commissioner Tigran and I worked together on a number of issues. I was trying to remember if she was co-author of this bill back then, but she's not sure that she was. But be that as it may, it was a bipartisan approach to reestablish the state board historically, Harry Mayers being probably the point person at one point, so when he chaired the Education Committee. Many of you wouldn't know him, but he was from White Bear Lake, and after we went into the minority and I had a role very similar to the current chair, Representative Mayers was the person who followed me in as chair of the Education Committee.
That's a great segue to Commissioner Seagram. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will just be brief. We are not supportive of establishing a state board, and the reasons are really pretty basic, and I think that Representative Demmer kind of alluded to them, that a lot of the things that are listed as duties that the state board used to perform are duties that really you as a legislature can and should be performing, and you have that vehicle, and the citizens and the community have that vehicle to have input to you as citizen legislators. For example, rulemaking. Rulemaking is something that is done through your auspices, your charge to the agency to create rules. The rulemaking process itself is a very public process that you have to bring in many people to, and you have to have experts to develop the rules. In fact, when the state board was in existence, I'm assuming that many of the support services that the state board required were delivered by the Department of Education and their expertise. You have to have people that know how to take all of the federal guidelines, et cetera, to change them into a state rule or into rules that that reflect that, et cetera. But what you're actually doing is having a lot of your agencies do that work, or you're having people in the legislature actually bring forth the ideas that then have to be promulgated anyway. Waiver requests are really are pretty just fundamental, are basic things that happen in the infrastructure and the running of a business or whatever, and waivers generally are you know, pretty cut and dried. Charter schools, you know, we are right in the process of, I think there was a decision that there was discomfort actually with the State Board of Education being a sponsor of charter schools, and I think that's what we moved to our current structure where we have independent sponsorship. The governing of the Minnesota Residential Academies, you have oversight over that as you should because you spend a lot of money there. You really should be having oversight of that and not have an appointed board that would have oversight over that kind of an expenditure. Public forums and study sessions, those are things that you really should be doing yourselves as legislators. Those are things that you should be exploring. Putting that aside and not having you all involved in doing that would not really be very wise, I think. So, you know, I think you have the ability. I know with this chair, I brought in a lot of national experts to talk to the committees, to, you know, think about things, think about the latest cutting edge things that were going on in the nation. Those are things that you should be doing. I think that those things are, again, something that is reflective of what you as a legislative body should be doing. So when I look at the list of things, looking at technology issues, you've got a couple of wonderful representatives that have really been charging ahead on technology standards. I can think of many, many things that have happened over the last number of years. that really are legislative duties, and a state board is just another layer. There are many different state board configurations. There are appointed boards, and I think Representative Carlson did go through the history of that. Many of them, the commissioner chairs the state board, but again, it is, you have another layer of people that become, in fact, all of the colleagues. I was just out in Washington, D.C., and by the way, I got to see President Obama. I was very excited, as well as Secretary of Education Duncan. Secretary Obama surprised us yesterday. We were talking about the stimulus, and he came in and talked a little bit about the charge that he wants us to do as a nation with educating our students and having high standards, et cetera. So it was pretty exciting yesterday. But many of the chiefs that I work with say that, you know, it's another, besides the legislature, besides the governor, if they are not appointed by the governor, and then a state board, there are now three entities by which you have to start navigating, and it becomes a pretty complicated process. And if you think it's not political, it is. Because no matter who is appointed, it is another layer that can get into politics, particularly if there's any kind of a controversial issue. It does become just another way that you can kind of get into even more discussion. So I respect Representative Carlson so very, very much, and it's always painful, you know, to disagree with someone that you respect so much. But I really do think that it's just another layer of bureaucracy that really doesn't serve any purpose other than to have some appointed people that really don't have the elected authority that you all have to do the same work that I think many of the things that they were doing, and then handing off to somebody that really had to then make the decision and have the discussion once again before it was actually passed into law. So that's my recommendation, that this perhaps be something that is not done because it's not really necessary.
Thank you, Commissioner. We do have, we won't be able to get to it on the agenda today, House File 1186, which is sort of the chair's way of perhaps offering either a complement or an alternative to Representative Carlson's approach, in keeping with Commissioner Segrin's exhorting us that there are, in fact, duties that we should be performing. And what I have learned over the last 3 years is that there is a hunger in this body to be able to access, indeed, a non-political tool that could provide needed resources based on research, that can provide advice that's based on research for legislative decision-making that does not necessarily need to come out of the other branch of government, as important as the work that the department does in this regard. And I hope we'll be able to get to that bill at our next hearing. I do want to take a vote on this bill. We're going to have to change the motion, I believe, but Representative Carlson, perhaps you can give us your summation and parting advice.
Well, I think I appreciate the time, because you gave me more time than we originally had planned. I cited the reasons that I felt that the State Board was important to be created. One that really didn't come up again with the commissioner's testimony or mine that I would like to reemphasize, and that is the structure that we created, where we try to bring higher education into the equation, the transition, and also the point that I made that we should bring, if the bill moves forward and would have to go to government op, I think is what the change in motion will have to be, that we would bring early childhood into the equation. So we would have a input from literally early ed through graduate education.
Representative Carlson, I'm told that indeed this would beg a GovOp vetting. However, my understanding is that the way our processes work, we can also choose to move this bill to K-12 finance, where it can have further vetting for those issues there, and then still be able to have a GovOp vetting of some sort. I think that works, and I think the chair of K-12 finance is amenable to working that out with the author. I guess I would ask for your advice, and I'll make the motion accordingly.
Mr. Chairman, when I was in your role, we did it both ways. And one of the things that we did sometimes, if you move it to finance, and then if I referred it to K-12 finance, or when I did, that would be routine. We would probably have a conversation with the chair of government ops to see if he needs to see the bill. And if he did, then there's a couple of ways you could handle that. You could have an informational hearing, or he could request it. If he requested it, then we could re-refer it there. Not the whole finance bill, but the bill, and then take it from there.
Very well. Then it seems the most prudent and flexible motion would be to if the bill passes, to be able to move it to finance. Then. So I would, I don't know if I'm, I guess I am remaking my motion that House File 466 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. To finance. And that's sort of a nexus point at which they can decide from there. Very well. We all know the motion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Carlson.
Thank you, and members of the committee.
And members, I had hoped to get through a couple of other bills, and I apologize to the testifiers on both of those bills. Things went a little bit slower than I thought they would at the beginning of the hearing. Hopefully we can indulge your good citizenship and ask you to come back at a subsequent hearing. Until tomorrow at 8:30, this committee stands adjourned.